conscience. This wonderful conference of ours, this new instrument of AA, is no longer, it is a magnificent reality. It is a high adventure into the realm of the spirit that already promises great success. Though few realize it yet, I think that we who are gathered here have become the keepers of the conscience for all of this fellowship. Despite our preoccupation with facts, figures, and funds, this is no business operation. That can be simply illustrated when you and I hear of a suffering brother or sister, and we get into the family automobile, having to drive perhaps 50 miles to pay a call. We look at the needle on the dashboard and see whether there is any gas in the tank. And if there isn't, we go to a garage and we get it filled. And we pay money and put gas into that tank. Not with the idea of giving our fellow sufferer a drink of gasoline, but with the idea of propelling us to where he is. Thereby, the material and money side of this thing serves a spiritual purpose. When we arrive, we offer our friend love, and we offer him understanding. And that is the cup of which he drinks. Neither is this conference in any sense a political body. None of us have come here with any idea of gain in personal prestige or of money. We have come here not to govern, but to ensure that these services of ours move on and fill their appointed task. I'm sure that in a few years, everybody will realize that this yearly gathering of ours is in reality the true voice of Alcoholics Anonymous. The sure conscience of our society and its beating heart, bringing new life to all those who don't yet know. In the early days, the conscience of this society resided among a few scattered individuals, at first not known to each other at all. And in them, this divine spark caused them to think the right thought and to do the right thing. Very few of us know that this spark, which was to become Alcoholics Anonymous, was first struck in the soul of a psychiatrist. Noted Carl Jung. He had a patient, treated him for a year. There was no result. And then that very great man put aside his professional pride. He said to the patient, "It's of no use. My art cannot help you. You're an alcoholic of such hopelessness that only a spiritual awakening can expel your obsession." So that man, who I shall call Roland, went out to seek such an awakening. He found it in the Oxford group of that time. And this was a body of people full of goodwill, trying to get the right thought and trying to take the right action. And he found there the experience that Dr. Jung hoped he would get. He became sober. He and another alcoholic came to an old friend of mine, the one we so affectionately know as Ebby. And temporarily, Ebby sobered up. And then the spark was struck in Ebby, and he came to me, as each of us have since come, one to another. And he set the flame going in me. Then paired another individual, a veritable founder of this movement, and he was non-alcoholic, Dr. Silkworth, at Towns Hospital. And I can never forget that day, so critical for Alcoholics Anonymous, when the doctor came into my room after I had had my spiritual awakening, and I asked him in great anxiety, "Doctor, have I gone crazy?" Well, as a professional man, he might have said, "Yes, you're hallucinating." But he didn't. That little man with the healing art in his hands and the love of drunks in his heart said to me, "No, Bill, you have got hold of something. I don't know just what it is, but it's real. You'd better hang on to it." Another man with a conscience who got the right thought and did the right thing at just the right time. And with that assurance, I went out to work with alcoholics, wherever they could be found. And the little doctor, at risk to his reputation, let me come back to that hospital and work there. Well, I guess my conscience wasn't in very good working order, it has spelled like that. Because for 6 months, nobody got sober. But during that time, I discovered that working with these others had a great bearing on keeping me sober. Then came my journey to Akron, where I thought my business career might be revived. You remember how that flopped. How discouraged I was, how frightened I became, when for the first time it seemed as though I might get drunk. Then you remember how I realized that now I needed another alcoholic as much as he needed me. So in seeking out this other alcoholic in a strange town, I called up a number of people who might put me in touch with such a person. But they were all busy with their own affairs, excepting one at the end of a list of 10. She was a non-alcoholic, but she had time, and she cared enough. And she said, "I think I know the man you want to meet." Well, that lady was Henrietta Stiver of Akron, and it was she who brought Dr. Bob and me together. Another person whose conscience gave her the right thought and the right action. Then Dr. Bob and I went to work in Akron, and the spark was passed from us. to very few others. Returning to New York, more humble, realizing now that I needed drugs just as much as they needed me, another group began to take shape. The spark that was to become Alcoholics Anonymous had been struck. Well, in those days, we were very anonymous indeed. You see, the good old Oxford groupers had given us certain principles that we could use, but many of their attitudes were unsuitable to the nature of the alcoholic. Thereby, I can testify that we owe them a double debt. They taught us both what and what not to do. We were obliged to withdraw from their company and go it alone. 3 years passed, years of terrific uncertainty. A slip in those days was a terrible thing because we all looked at each other and said, who will be next? Then comes another great turning point. Dr. Bob and I sit in his living room in Akron at the end of 3 years. We commence to count noses. And lo and behold, here are a couple score people, terrible drunks indeed, for in those days we could only deal with the very worst. Only they would admit they were licked. And looking over this list, we suddenly realized that enough time had elapsed on enough cases so that something new had come into our dark world. No new ideas, to be sure, just a new assembly of old ideas. And these had come into us through the several channels I have named and others, as the grace of God, setting his blessing on what was to happen. Following this realization, we at once began to consider how this message could be spread. For the first time, in reality, we began to think in terms of function and of service and of an outgoing love that could place this message before all the drunks in the world, so we ambitiously said, even back then. How could that be done? Well, at this point, we began to see the group conscience manifest itself. There was a little meeting at T. Henry Williams' house in Akron, one of our great non-alcoholic friends out there. And the meeting was called to consider ways and means of spreading this message. The meeting divided itself into two parts. One said, let's keep it simple. If we complicate it with money, paraphernalia like hospitals, paid people, we shall be ruined. And then there was another part of the meeting which said, but if we don't do some of these things, people will die because the message will not reach them in time. Our story may get horribly dark. Perhaps something ought to be done. So the group conscience, as such, spoke for perhaps the first time. And it directed me, who had only begun to sense that I was its servant rather than its master, to go back to New York and get a hold of a lot of money to set up a chain of hospitals, to get quite a lot of people on the payroll, because the going had been so tough that we thought we ought to extend our experienced members to other cities. And above all, we thought that an instrument of propagation would be necessary in the shape of a book, which would state our experience in recovery. So a book, some missionaries, some hospitals, we must have. I came back to New York full of these ideas, convinced that we should have all of these things, and right away, the quicker the better. I did a good deal of solicitation of people for months. But everybody, fortunately, looked the other way. One day I was in my brother-in-law's office. He's a doctor. And I was grousing about the stinginess of the rich when it came to fixing drunks. And he said, you know, I remember a man by the name of Willard S. Richardson. I believe he was very close to the Rockefeller family, had something to do with their charities. I'm not sure he's even alive. But supposing I call up over there at the Rockefeller offices and find out. Again, a critical turning point in our affair. Somebody with the right thought and the right action. Immediately, dear Willard Richardson, one of the greatest friends this society will ever have, came on the wire and he said to my brother-in-law, Leonard, where have you been all these years? Soon we were in his office. I was telling the story. He listened with great attention. He said, let me call together a group of friends. I think they'll want to hear this story. Well, for a fellow who needed a lot of money, I thought he did, this all looked pretty good. So, on a winter's night in 1937, we all sat down in Mr. John D. Rockefeller's boardroom. We all, meaning a few of us alcoholics, Willard S. Richardson, my brother-in-law, Frank Amos and Leroy Chipman, who are still with us on our board, Mr. Scott, chairman of the Riverside Church, Dr. Silkworth, perhaps a few others. Well, we alcoholics were rather stunned by this turn of events. And in a rather halting fashion, each one of us told his story of recovery. And then the chairman of the meeting, Mr. Scott, said, well, how can we help you? And by this time, I got in good voice again and began to enlarge on our great need for lots of money for hospitals, missionaries, and particularly as some needed to publish a book, the experience. Right there, Mr. Scott said, well, isn't it a fact, Bill, that the great power in this thing sober up drunks is dependent upon the non-professional character of your work? Isn't it this goodwill message carried from person to person without any demand for reward that really counts? I'm powerfully attracted to this because it's like the original Christian story. Aren't you afraid that the responsibility of plant, property, management, and all that sort of thing goes forward? Well, we rejoined that we were scared. On the other hand, we were scared to do nothing and let this thing run from by word of mouth. The upshot of that meeting was that one of those present, Frank Amos, who was sitting right over there, at his own expense, went out to Akron to look over the situation. We directed him toward Akron because the first group had really started there. It was a typical community. And also, we knew that Smithy was a little bit harder up than I was. He was about to lose his house. Frank went out there and came back with a glowing report. It was the spirit of the thing that had moved him. He made out a report, what he saw. I believe he recommended that some sort of a rest home be set up out there, and Dr. Smith could be put in charge as a doctor rather than as a professional therapist for alcoholics. He recommended a sum of money that wasn't large, but large enough to make us poor drunks kind of gag. The recommendation was carried to Mr. John D. Rockefeller. So here comes another man with a right thought and the right idea at the right time. And the thought was totally unexpected, and at first very disappointing to us. Mr. Rockefeller, it is said, looked up to his friend Dick, who had brought him the report, said, "Dick, don't you think that money will spoil us?" There's something about this that is deeply moving. "We must spoil it with money, Dick." Well, Mr. Richardson wasn't entirely sure, but Mr. Rockefeller, for some strange reason, was very sure and maintained that attitude ever since. And he has since told me that nothing more affecting has ever crossed his life than the contact with this society of ours. At any rate, he put a little money in the Riverside Church treasury, and that enabled Smithy and me to wiggle along. Then we went out among the alcoholics here and got money to publish our book. And then we set about its writing. Well, the hassles and difficulties we experienced in getting that book together are simply beyond description. At that point, I was sure that this group of drunks had no conscience whatever because they quarreled so much. But nevertheless, a series of right actions and right thoughts at the right time brought the AA book into being. Although it seemed in 1939, after it came out, that we would soon lose it to the printer because, again, we were broke. But here was our first great instrument of service. This was something that could reach out over plains, mountains, and perchance the sea to the distant alcohol. And it was our hopeful dream that he might, through the pages of that book, recover and bring recovery to those about. In the very next year, 1940, Mr. Rockefeller reappeared and seen again, suddenly saying that he'd like to give a dinner. He would invite his friends, many of them prominent and wealthy. He'd invite some of us. Again, our hope for large funds flared up. We said to ourselves, this is it. The stories were heard at the meeting. Even the bankers present were visibly impressed. Things looked good when John D. Rockefeller, or rather Nelson Rockefeller, got up and said that his father was very glad he could not, that his friends could hear this story, but that this was a movement which rested upon goodwill and needed little, if any, money. I never can forget the terrible feeling in the pit of my stomach as I watched about $5 billion walk out the door. Now, that story went on the AP and the UP press wire. The story how Mr. Rockefeller had stood up before the whole world and pointed to this struggling society of drunks and had said for all men to hear, "This is good. I believe in it. He did this at risk to himself, at personal cost. He gave of himself, but not of his money, excepting for a little bit. After the dinner, he wrote a personal letter to all those who had been invited, as well as to those who actually came. Sent them a pamphlet describing what had happened, publishing the talk. By the way, Dr. Harry Emerson Fosdick came down and gave us a great plug. So did Foster Kennedy, the celebrated neurologist, our friends of medicine and religion had begun to appear, you see. So this letter contained a little paragraph at the end, which said, well, this is a movement of goodwill, doesn't require much money, perhaps a little temporary aid. And Mr. Rockefeller's very wise idea of a little temporary aid was in the statement in which he said, I am giving these people $1,000. Well, when the bankers received the letter, they sort of tied it up on the cuff, you know, and said, well, if John D.'s given $1,000, I'll send in 10, which one of them really did. The result of that was $3,000, and we had $3,000 a year from those dinner people for 5 years, and praise God, that's all of the outside money this society ever had. We were throwing on our own resources. Then in the fall of 1939, another kind of person with the right thought came to our aid. A non-alcoholic in the person of Fulton Alger, who had just taken his leave of us. He was then editor of Liberty. We were completely unknown. The Reader's Digest had turned us down on their promise of publicity. We needed to let the world understand what this message was. So Fulton Osler caused to be published in Liberty Magazine a piece called Alcoholics and God. And to our great joy, this brought in 800 scattered inquiries. And we wrote each one very carefully from our little office, which had by now been established, another step in the service picture. We also sold these alcoholics and their wives and friends a few books. And that book income sort of kept our little office going down here in Beezy Street, New York, so we could answer those inquiries. So we had taken another step in service, another step in outgoing love toward all those who still didn't know. Then came the great payoff. Attention had been attracted to us. The editors of the Saturday Post sat in conference one day trying to figure out whether they publish a piece about it. Mr. Curtis Bott sat there, one of the owners of the Post, I believe. The editors were very much in doubt about this obscure society. So here was another man with the right thought at the right time. And he said, I know of several recoveries. They are nothing less than miraculous. I think we should publish a piece about this. And that's how, in 1941, Jack Alexander published that marvelous story in the Saturday Post that brought in thousands of frantic inquiries and made us a national institution overnight. Now, that is a brief account of our pioneering time, in which you see the spirit of service and the idea of spreading this message beginning to develop. You also see how we were saved from the perils of professionalism, large property ownership, and all of that. We were saved in spite of ourselves by our friends. After the post piece, pandemonium broke loose. We wrote all these inquiries, every single one, a personal letter. Some more books moved out. We began to get lists of our brother and sister alcoholics still suffering in other cities and distant places. And we got track of traveling businessmen and salesmen out of the few established groups. And we put these lists in their hands so that when they went to distant towns, they could call upon those alcoholics. And this mushrooming process began. AA began to spread just like wildfire. Thus we entered our period of adolescence, and a very exciting and dangerous period it was. We knew that God had given us a formula by which the obsession of alcoholism could be expressed. But we didn't know whether we could live and work together in unity and have sufficient unity to carry the message to those who still didn't know. That was the primary problem of our adolescent period. So that the problem of this service office down here in New York was not only that of receiving inquiries from individuals. Groups frantic with problems began to write in about them. Of course, AA began to be filled up with promoters. Most of us are salesmen of a sort. And again, our early temptations were presented to us thousands upon thousands of times. Temptations to make a lot of money out of this thing. Temptations to put AA into business. Struggles for prestige among individuals. All sorts of crackpot schemes were tried. And out of this vast welter of experience, which gradually informed and instructed the group conscience, there began to evolve the tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous. And each of us began to see that this society of ours was of immensely more importance than any individual in it. We began to find that in certain respects, the common welfare would have to come ahead of individual welfare, and especially of individual ambition. By this time, we found that the group conscience, which had appeared so erratic, was a better guide to what we really needed in the shape of action and sound principle than the inspired wisdom of any leader. Now, that dawned very slowly upon me, I must confess. Every one of those AA traditions represents what was a great temptation to me, from which I was not saved so much through any virtue in me as I was from the wisdom that is inherent in this group, where its welfare is concerned. So I conceded that the welfare, the common welfare, had to come first. I conceded that the, reluctantly too, that the group conscience was often wiser than I was. I conceded that in membership matters, nobody could keep an alcoholic out of AA. I conceded, rather rebelliously, that each group ought to be autonomous, that there could be no such thing in our society as a central government to be run by me or any hierarchy. that each group would have to have liberty of action. So we had group of tongues. Then came that struggle with the idea of whether we would, after all, become professional. And at one point, I was tempted to become a professional therapist. But the drunks in the meeting in my living room over in Clinton Street, when I announced this plan, looked at me, and one of them finally said, "Phil, you can't do this to us." Happily, I listened to the group conscience as it spoke through this man, and I obeyed. And so, the AA tradition developed, one by one. And I was not the only reluctant one. Each of us went through our period of reluctance about these principles because each one of them was deflationary to us personally. They ran counter to our nature. They ran counter to our natural desires. That was especially true when we come to the non-controversy tradition. Gee, we love to fight. But we very early saw that there were certain things that we couldn't fight about and survive. The kind of things that the outside world calls about. Religion. Politics. No. Neither could we quarrel in public about anything or attack anybody. That became true. Neither could we give endorsements or form alliances to do even the best of good work, lest it compromise our single aim, which had settled down by then to carrying sobriety to the alcoholic who wants. Then in that matter of anonymity, many of us have had our temptation, and no one more than I have. My temptation was to sign that AA book, but I could hear the group conscience speaking, and it said, "No, you can't do this to us." And then I found what each of us have found, little by little, with respect to AA's 12 steps and AA's 12 traditions. At first, we rebel. Then we're reluctant. Then we intellectually accept these principles, saying these are good things. These are what we should have as persons. These are what we should have as a society. And then we take one more step, and intellect is transferred into right emotion. And we say, that is what I want for me, and for AA. And thus, we pass through the period of adolescence. Meanwhile, our friends had rallied around us. They'd helped form this thing that we called the Alcoholic Foundation, which acted as a custodial board. Our little office, which once just got out the book, expanded into the service office. The title of the book was transferred to the Board of Trustees. Our public, overall public relations were given into their custody. The grapevine fell under their direction. And so evolved this cluster of services here in the center that enabled AA to function as whole. But several years back, some of us began to be very concerned, because we felt there was still a missing link in this picture. We realized that this foundation and its central activities was still very remote from the group, that there wasn't too much knowledge of it. We couldn't talk too much about it, lest that talk defeat itself. It would look like it was self-serving. Smithy and I awoke with a start to discover that we were the main links between these services and those served. So, after the hottest kind of debate, I assure you, and after a lot of real dissension, in which I often acquitted myself ignobly, the conscience of this group finally came up with this basic idea. Our central services must be made the function of the whole movement. We must build many links from these services out to you. For we are now on the threshold of maturity. The principles of recovery are established. The principles of unity are established. Now you must come and take your third legacy. This legacy of overall service to this movement and to all who haven't arrived in it yet. And that idea began to germinate, began to grow, and became fulfilled 3 sessions back, when in 1951 we held the first General Service Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous. That leads us where we are this morning. We are standing on the threshold of maturity, although no one could say in truth that we are really mature yet. This process of maturing, of course, we'll go on as long as we last. Now, I have been asked to speak on the milestones ahead. And I have dwelled at length on the milestones we have already passed because I dislike the role of a prophet. For I certainly am not that. I have been mistaken too often. But I think that we can take a look ahead to this extent. We can look at the problems that occupy our immediate foreground. Now, it is plain to all of us that unless this society can develop enough brotherhood and partnership among its members, we shall someday fall into disunity. And the basis of partnership and brotherhood has to be greatly improved personal relations. Now, it is true that the love of one drunk for another is a wonderful thing to behold. When the stranger is on the doorstep and we carry this message to him, we don't think of personal reward in any ordinary sense. He isn't going to pay us. He may not even love us. We don't expect a thing except the inner glow which one gets from having love and from offering the right kind of love to a fellow human being. In our case, another drunk, especially. So we make him the offer. If he turns us down, well, we say there are plenty more drugs. If he carries it on and we see no more of him, we say, isn't that wonderful? If he returns to become our bosom friend, well, then we're really joyful. But we realize that that joy, that gladness, that satisfaction is the extra dividend of AA life. The really sustaining thing is that we receive God's love just in proportion as we have love for others and try to give that away. So that in our 12 steps, there is an expression of almost pure love, the kind of love that has no price tag on it. Now then, what happens, though, when we move away from the 12 steps and our relations with people become closer. There we tend to revert to type again. Take this whole subject of domestic relations. How many of us are there now who can go home with the same kind of love for a faithful and long-suffering wife that we have had down at the clubhouse for our alcoholic spouse? Well, lots of us can. But lots of us can't. Not yet. Because there has been a profound distortion in family life due to our drinking. This is one of the overhangs. So there is a whole area of personal relationships which has to do not only with sobriety, but it has to do with emotional sobriety. It has to do with the joy of living. And there is an area. I think I ought to refer to these family groups where our wives and husbands, the wives and husbands of alcoholics, are realizing that they too have become distorted and are now forming themselves into groups to find out what the matter is with them and how the 12 steps can help them to be better partners. The numbers of those groups have increased in the last year from 200 to 400. Almost like the early pyramiding process in AA. And I think that they will help fill this huge vacuum. But we alcoholics, too, must do our part. Well, then in AA, as I say, we sometimes quarrel a great deal. Not often about things that matter too much. But there is a great deal of unnecessary anger, ambition, pride, a tendency to dominate people or a tendency to cling to people. All those problems of personal relationships which have to do with emotional sobriety, happy sobriety, are yet far from solution. And when we have moved on and made a great gash in those problems, we shall have passed another milestone. Then there is the problem of the completion. AA. He comes in, he does good work, the family is reunited, family is happy, income is good, kids don't get into any trouble, and he assumes that he's cured. He thinks he's done his bit. For AA. Well, most of us know that at some bent him with a great big lump, which he is nowhere near prepared to spot. So he and those who are coasting blissfully might take another look at our 12 steps, not just the first and the 12th, but all those in between, and try harder to apply them in all their affairs, and try harder to be more responsible about their AA obligations. Great progress can be made there. Then this matter of sponsoring new people. Since we have got large in numbers, the careful attention that we used to give is sometimes denied new people. They come into our larger meetings, they wander about. Our sponsorship is still defective. We can do much about improving that. We can remember the kind of chance that somebody gave us. And the desire can again burn in every one of us to give that next fellow his chance and not leave the job to Joe Doe. Now, to be prudent is not necessarily to be fearful. Curiously enough, this society as a whole is a society which has never had a problem that is cut clear across it. The individual has been cut to pieces with problems, and he has grown together. So have groups. So have others. But AA as a whole has never been cut across by a great problem or a great calamity. Now we are living in the world. It seems largely filled with nothing but problems and calamities. And for all of these last 17 or 18 years, God has spared our society anything that looks like a big problem. In the meanwhile, this has permitted our reputation to be made secure in the public mind. We are now prepared to meet serious problems if they come. And it is not fearful to say that serious problems will still someday come to AA as a whole. Just take one not too serious, and let us try to think how we would behave if this occurred. I know of an author, for example, who is a humorist on the sarcastic side. I think he tends to imbibe a little himself. And two or three years ago, he got together material for a funny book about AA, which would have roundly ridiculed it. The book was never published because he found too many of his old writing cronies in AA and they destroyed it. But supposing that he had published that book, you know what our first reaction would have been? It would have been a reaction of great rage. He can't do this to us. But does that necessarily have to be our reaction? When we are unfairly criticized, loudly criticized at some time in the future, or actually attacked, are we prepared to take such attacks in silence and in dignity with no thought of retaliation? And if there is any truth, in some we humbly say that our society stands corrected. To meet the larger problems of the future, we will have to think about how we would behave and act if this society would survive. Otherwise, we can become hopelessly involved in controversies at the public level and destroy this wonderful reputation we have, which is already, I must say, a damn sight better than our character. Today, the world is full of political division, warring philosophies, warring nations. Supposing that those divisions cut deep in this country sometime, and our society as such starts to quarrel, shall we find the wisdom and grace at such a time to say no? As of old, these are matters on which AAs can never quarrel within the confines of this society. This is the sort of quarreling that can destroy us and the chance for sobriety and a new way of life for all who might come. Shall we be able to put that temptation aside when it arrives? Conceivably, we could have a religious division. I don't believe we will, but we must. How shall we deport ourselves then? And on how we act, much will depend. Much will depend on what this body, the conscience of Alcoholics Anonymous is told, says and does at such a critical juncture. Not personally, Pace seems to blame those problems. Because I think we are ready for them, really. I think we can manage them. And I think we can manage them because of what I see here before me. I see God speaking through the group conscience in this room. And I feel that our guidance will be true. That the voice of Alcoholics Anonymous will remain clear. That its conscience is now so experienced and well related to God that it can apprehend the right thing to do at the right time. Despite all these perils of the road, I know that you share with me an utter confidence about our future. Now, there's just one more temptation to which this movement may be subjected. All around us, men are commencing to say, why, this AA thing is a lot more than a cure for drunks. It's a way of life that could save civilization. Mr. Herbert Hoover, several years ago, paused in the middle of a policy talk and pointed to this society as one whose spirit ought to animate the whole world. Since that time, we've had a great number of clergymen, public men, heads of the Chamber of Commerce. A fellow came in my house the other day from the United Nations, said that ideas he got from the AA tradition had transformed the whole status of relief work in Greece. The week before, a man came in who is a very noted philosopher in this country and member of one of its most respected religions. And he said to me, Bill, I begin to sense that this AA thing has a deeper destiny than just sobering up drunk. It may be the spearhead of a new religious evolution. Well, at first that sort of thing made me feel good. It made me feel ambitious. It made me feel as though, well, now that we're well on the way to sobering up all the drunks in the world, why not sober up all the people in the world, emotionally speaking? And then prudence intervened and said to me, as I know it must have said to you, these are things that we should never say about ourselves. The more we mind our own business, the more we offer with success what we have to the next alcoholic, the longer we shall last, and the larger will be our usefulness, even to the world outside. So to you, at this third General Service Conference, I say welcome, and may God speak in your conscience. May your voice be clear and true. And may the great service heart of Alcoholics Anonymous, which beats in the center of this gathering, continue to beat for so long as God shall meet it.